This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. You may not have heard of Instructure, but your kids likely have, and certainly their teachers know about Instructure's flagship product, Canvas, that services millions of students and teachers across America. It's a software that lets students, parents, teachers, and administrative staff all communicate seamlessly and share data easily. The education market is large and in need of better technology tools if teachers are going to lead students into the ever-changing, fast-paced, and competitive landscape that defines our future. And Instructure is doing just that. Earlier this year, Instructure raised $40 million at a valuation of over half of $1 billion. In total, Instructure has raised $90 million and employs over 500 people. The company is one of the country's leaders in learning management systems for colleges, K-12, and now even the corporate training world. Josh Coates, thank you for joining us today on The Bottom Line.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So why don't you start by telling our audience about Instructure's first product, Canvas. What does it do?
Well, Canvas is software that helps run the classroom, whether that's a third grade class in Kansas or a graduate course at Stanford, and everything in between. So it's the software where the teacher says, hey, turn the homework in this weekend. There's going to be a quiz on Tuesday online, and I want to see you guys working on this project in your groups. All that stuff's on the website, and that website he's talking about is Canvas.
It's a completely different world that my teenage girls are going through school and the tools they have than the tools that I had, right? We used to hand in our papers,
yep.
And now they do it all on Google Docs, and it's their school, Wileman and Park City High School, use your product. So I see it all the time. Frankly, I'm glad I went to school when I did. It seemed a lot easier back then to just hand in the physical stuff. And when I was in school, they did not even have one of the first movers, one of the large players is one of your competitors, Blackboard. And I heard a lot of people 10 years ago, 7 years ago, talk about what an awful product Blackboard is and was. What was the challenge with Blackboard, and how did that present an opportunity for Instructure?
Well, yeah, Blackboard kind of owned the market for quite a while. They had a large patent portfolio and were not afraid to use it and abuse it. And they really kept competitors out of the market. They were very litigious. And for many years, that really stifled innovation. And so it left a great opportunity for someone to come in and disrupt the market. I think a lot of times if you are protecting your market share by other means other than innovation, then you really leave yourself vulnerable, and that's sort of what happened here.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because that was what I was struck by. You know, I didn't deal with the software, but I had friends that were in academia, and they really disliked that tool. They had a dislike for not only the tool and how it worked, but also just how they were treated by the company. And I want to circle, because I know the founders of the firm, Brian Whitmore and Devin Daly, they were students at BYU. In fact, they took a class that you were teaching at the time. What were they hoping to accomplish in the early days with Canvas?
Well, I think at the time they just really felt like, you know, the Blackboard software that they were subjected to as students at Brigham Young University, they just didn't like the software. It was, frankly, pretty crappy stuff. And they simply wanted to bring a modern, positive software experience to education. And that was the simple vision. And in my course, I was an adjunct instructor for a few years at BYU and in the computer science department. And I taught intro to venture startups. And, of course, we put the students in groups, and they work on sort of a virtual startup. Devlin and Brian, kind of just said, "Hey, we think it'd be great to make a startup around killing Blackboard and bringing modern software to to education. So that's kind of where it came from. They started out with something familiar with them themselves.
Were they passionate about this space before your class, or do you think it was really, hey, we got to do this for an assignment for the class? All right, this is our best idea. Let's run with this. Or do you think they always thought, we want to start a company out of this?
Well, I think coming into the course, I don't think they ever thought, oh, hey, you know what? I want to be, when I grow up, I want to be a founder of a software company that takes out Blackboard. I don't think that was in their mind.
Some people, I do talk to some entrepreneurs that, you know what? From the time they were 15 years old, they knew this was the space that they were going to go after.
Yeah, I think, you know, I sort of make stuff up as I go along. So I'm not one of those people. But I think they were passionate about education and they were passionate about software. And so it seemed to line up quite well. And when they began to realize that there was an opportunity to disrupt this space, after the course was over, you know, handed out their grades, I think they got A minuses. I can't remember. But they did quite well in the class. And then that summer, they approached me and said, hey, we actually want to do this for real. And that's when I advised them that was a terrible idea and they should go get real jobs.
And that was good advice, because taking on the market leader that had the IP portfolio that they had, that had a history of squashing startups, that's a tough space. Not only that, but they're going into a marketplace where the sales cycle is relatively long and the customers are risk adverse. And I'm sure those are all the plus many other things you shared with them. How did they overcome some of those obstacles? How did they survive and not get squished by Blackboard when so many people before them had been?
Well, I think the strategy that we really adopted at Instructure, I think the move of one being really open with the market, that yes, we're aware that everyone thinks Blackboard's going to buy us out or squash us. So we were really open in our blog and at conferences and really just kind of embrace this idea of the market. And also, we decided to go open source. So our product is an open source product. And that was a dual-pronged strategy. One is, philosophically, we thought it was important for the academic world to have an open source option that was backed by a commercial entity that was really serious and focused. And also, we figured that was a great way to inoculate ourselves against an acquisition from Blackboard. And so by being really open about things, both in our communication with the market, but also the actual software itself, we were really able to kind of keep Blackboard at bay in that way. And plus, the U.S. Patent Office invalidated all their patents.
That helped.
That helped
a
yeah,
lot.
That,
yeah.
So
when did that happen?
That happened in, I think that happened in 2000, I want to say 2008, the summer or fall of 2008.
So right around the time they were starting.
That's right.
Instructure. Okay.
Yep. So that really opened the doorway for us to come in and do that. And the reason why there was so few competitors for us to deal with in the early days is because investors for years had observed how difficult the academic market was and also how dominant a position Blackboard had. And so they didn't want to write a check to someone to go fight Goliath. That'd be foolish. And so when the patent portfolio got invalidated, you know, by then they had been trained, oh, don't invest in that. But they found someone dumb enough to write them a check and they hopped in the market.
In fact, many angel investors and venture capitalists still have that rule, right? A lot of them don't do life science deals. If you ask them, you know, what are your two or three I don't do markets? One's life science, and another one's the educational software space, because it is so challenging. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. So Brian and Devlin, in the summer of 2008, said, hey, we're going to go after this. We're going to make it a business. About 2 years later, you made an investment. You invested alongside of the guys at Epic Ventures here in Salt Lake City. Where were they at that point? So they'd been out a year and a half, 2 years. Did they have customers? What was their traction like?
I actually wrote them a check in 2008. I when they approached me and said, hey, we want to go do this for real, I said, well, if you're really serious about it, stop writing code, go visit 20 schools, show them a virtual version of your product, and then come back with a verbatim transcript of what those meetings are like, and then I'll tell you if I think you have a business. And they did that. So they went out, and I think 17 or 18 schools, they hopped in their car and drove all over the West Coast, and they came back with transcripts, and I read through them, and it was really incredible. And so I said, oh, well, this is great. You've done great research. You know, clearly these people are interested in the kind of software you're writing. They're tired of the incumbent. Surely a venture capitalist will write you a check. You guys have really done a great job on your homework, and there's obviously an opportunity here. So
no customers yet.
No. Okay. It was just the two of them, and they had a little bit of software and had done some market validation. So we took them to a local venture capitalist, and they did their pitch. And I was present and saying, hey, you know, these guys are good kids, and they've done some great work here, and this is worth $50,000, the seed investment. You know, why don't you write them a check? And this VC kind of laughed at me and said, well, this isn't cool. EdTech isn't cool. This is, yeah, we're not interested. And I was just really floored by that. I thought, oh, my gosh, this is worth a little bet like this. And he laughed. He said, well, Josh, if you think it's so cool, why don't you write him a check? So I did. And then I wrote him,
You're glad you did.
Oh, yeah, it worked out well. And then a few months after that, I wrote him another check. And then a few months after that, I wrote him another check. And right. So it kind of nurtured them along financially for about a year and a half or two. And then I brought in Epic Ventures and a couple other small angels that I've worked with.
We should give Nick credit, right? It was
Nick Stratus.
Exactly.
Yeah, Nick.
Had
yeah.
the vision. So he was the first institutional money.
Exactly. He was the first real VC.
Yeah.
And I worked with Nick at my previous startup, Mosey. And so Nick invested in Mosey. And so he knew me. And you know, Nick was worried about ed tech as well. Everyone was at the time. But he could see the opportunity.
Right.
And so he wrote a check along with me, more checks. And by that time, that was probably 2000, end of 2009. And then towards the end of 2010, I think there was maybe six or seven employees. They still had no customers. And about that time, I decided they were out of money. and they were having a rough time with things, and I came on as CEO at that time.
Okay. Yeah. So a couple things. One, I think your advice to them, stop coding and go talk to the market. They probably weren't expecting that from an adjunct professor teaching a computer science class at Brigham Young University.
Well,
I think it's really good advice.
I covered that in my second lecture. They just didn't take good notes. No, it's true. I mean, that's a pretty standard. In computer science, of course, you know, people like coding. That's what it's
exactly.
all about. But no, what I found teaching my course is they were a great test case, right? Because everything that I taught in my course happened in real life and in structure. But learning it in the classroom and learning it in real life are radically different things, because when you're living it, that's when you really learn it. Academically, I think it went in one ear and out the other with these guys and with everybody I've ever taught, because there's been a number of small companies that have come out of my courses, and they always forget everything and call me up and say, how does this work again?
You know, it's unfortunate. Most of us have to learn things the hard way by our own experience as opposed to the smart way, which is learning from other people's experiences. And that's why having a mentor and somebody alongside them during their journey is so important. At some point, your role switched from being a mentor and an investor to saying, you know what, I'm going to join your team. I assume you joined as CEO when you came in.
Yep.
What did that process look like, and why did you decide to go from being an outside investor to an active member of the team?
So it was kind of, we were looking for a CEO for Instructure at the time. They were ready to go to market, and we needed kind of the next level of leadership. And it was, it's hard hiring a CEO. I mean, I started interviewing CEOs with Nick of Stratus at Epic, and we started looking for him. And
I'm sure Nick had a game plan from day one.
Sure.
But we got to get Josh in this company.
Oh, I've never asked him if that was his secret plan, but it may have been. I don't know. But we were interviewing people, and it was just tough. It was hard. It's like, man, it's really hard to find someone willing to come in when, you know, There's almost no money in the bank. There's no customers. It's high risk. And to find a CEO willing to take that on. And at about the same, I had been retired for several years by then. And I have young kids. And I thought, I guess I could pretend to have a job for a while and be a good example to my kids and maybe, try to make sure this investment isn't a total loss. And
the challenge is there's no pretending, though, right? I mean, the CEO is kind of an either or type position.
Yeah, no. Once
there
you
strap is no
in.
Way to do it 40 hours a week. I mean, I'm sure your week, many weeks are much more than 40 hours. It's a very intense job. So coming out of retirement, it'd be great if there was the 20 to 30 hour a week option. I've seen people try that. It generally doesn't work because it's so demanding. Why do you think that is? Why do you think the CEO has to come in and give 110% and you can't do that part-time?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly, at that stage in the company, there's part-time stuff doesn't work. And I've seen that over and over again where people say, I'm in a startup, but I also have another job. That doesn't work. You have to be all in and all committed.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. So we were just chatting about, CEO's full-time job. We've seen folks try to do it as a part-time job. It just doesn't work. It's so hard to do. Another thing I see is I'll see a non-technical person with a great business idea, and they outsource the coding, the technology, which I think to get to a minimum viable product, to show investors, maybe to get the first couple hundred users is okay. But after that, you need to have your own team in-house. First, as somebody that's running a technology company, would you agree with that? And why do you? What's magical about having everybody together, particularly your coding team?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. I think it's pretty common to find idea guys and business guys that have these brilliant startup plans that don't really know a lot about technology and certainly can't code. Those people are generally unfundable. And they spend years networking and dreaming and spinning their wheels, and they're usually desperately in search of a technical phone co-founder, and so those are common kind of train wrecks to watch. Occasionally, they might be successful, but the vast majority of them are just sort of, it's like, hey man, you majored in the wrong major in school, and either learn how to code or go get a normal job. But really, you need, in my opinion, you need a technology at the core of your company, and that's either a founder or a CEO or some early employee that is your anchor. Tech companies are supposed to be just that, tech companies, and outsourcing code to some faraway land doesn't usually work. Those are usually disasters. I have never experienced success in outsourcing. I don't know anyone who has been successful outsourcing.
After a certain point, early on to proof of concept, get users, or just
maybe,
in general?
I don't know. It depends on how you define success, right. I guess. If you said, hey, we faked something together for our presentation to get investments, I guess you can call that a success.
So
I don't know.
Let's stay on this for a minute, because 99% of the people listening probably cannot code.
I know. I'm sorry I'm depressing your listeners.
But there's other options to learn to code other than getting a four-year degree at the U or at Brigham Young University.
Those usually don't work.
I was just going to ask your thoughts on that.
Yeah, there's a lot of learn how to code camps, and they're, call a spade, they're scams mostly. They're basically it's like those late night commercials on TV where they're like, learn to be a video game programmer, just pay us $30,000 a year and we'll get the loans from the government and you can get your four-year degree in 18 months. I mean, that stuff's all bunk. And there's a new wave of the same stuff where you take you know, guys that majored in psychology or sociology, and they realize that their degree is not terribly useful, and they really love technology, and they want to be a technical co-founder, and so they'll go pay 10 grand to go to a coding camp, and it's a waste of time and money. It'll get them a little bit familiar, and I'm talking about 98% of the participants. Now, you might have 2% that actually have, I mean, we have engineers, software engineers at Instructure that, you know, didn't get a degree or heck, we
self-taught
or probably, yeah, they're self-taught or, you know, we, one of our best engineers is, you know, got a law degree, right? They have brilliant natural talent, and that's something. There's two types of coders in the world: the ones that work their butts off and became decent, and then there's the talented ones. And the talented ones, man, that's amazing, but that's a special talent. You know, in fact, I wouldn't put myself in that category. I don't think I'm a particularly talented software engineer. I never have been. I worked really hard, but some people have that gift. But yeah,
I call those guys 10X programmers.
Sure, yeah.
Those are the guys, yeah, when you have the unsolvable problem,
yep,
can solve it.
Yeah, and those are amazing people. And this,
every company needs as many of those as they,
yeah,
can get, but they're really hard to get. Yeah,
and early on as well. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. Everyone has a different way of thinking about this. My personal view on this is that if you are not a coder and you want to do a startup, man, you better find a co-founder or a CTO or something that you can tie yourself to the hip and just run with it, because, you know, going and, you know, learning how to code real quick, that's a fool's errand.
Well, let's stay on this for just a little bit,
sure,
longer, because,
yeah,
if you are a non-technical individual that wants to start a company, the reality, and for good reason, I would argue, it is going to be harder for you to recruit a technical co-founder than it will be for you to raise money. Because think about it from the technical co-founder standpoint. They're going to join an unfunded company that's a dream, and they're going to build this company. If they're going to take that kind of risk, they might as well go after their own idea. Their other alternative is go work for a firm like Instructure that has a $500 million valuation.
Sure.
Your last round you described as a pre-IPO round. Hopefully there's an IPO, there's a,
yeah,
liquidity. So that technology guy has a lot of choices.
Oh, sure.
And working with this non-technical co-founder is probably not their best option.
So what
can that person do? So they're a non-technical,
okay,
person. The boot camps, you
yeah,
say, probably aren't going to help. What advice would you give to that person?
You know, I think Adobe's hiring. That's the advice I'd give them.
Go work a marketing job, you know, or a sales job.
I don't know. I mean, that's harsh, because there's someone out there listening that's not technical at all, that has a
should
vision.
They go get a 2-year, let's say they've got an undergrad, should they go get a 2 years master's in CS?
You know, it depends on what they love, right? If they really don't love the idea of building software, they shouldn't go build software, right? They shouldn't code, right? If they like the idea of building a product in a metaphorical way, you know, not a literal way, become a product manager. Learn the craft of organizing engineers and putting requirements together and talking to customers and being a product guy. And you can learn that anywhere. You know, go work at Microsoft, go work at Apple or Adobe or Instructure, or go learn that. And then you'll have something to bring to the table, right? The problem is a lot of these guys said, oh, I got a business degree. Well, what the hell good is that for? Nothing. Right.
I mean, the world changes, right? I was just listening to an interview with Steve Case recently, and he was talking about, you know, 60 years ago, the innovation hub of the United States was Detroit. And now clearly the innovation hub, I would argue Utah's one of them, but it's not Detroit anymore.
No.
Right. So the world changes. And 20 years ago, your ticket to do a startup was an MBA.
Yeah.
Preferably from a top 10 school.
Sure.
Those days are kind of over now, and I agree with a lot of the things that you're sharing here. The one thing I would add is, if you are going to take your second choice and be a product manager, or, you know, give up the dream of starting a technology company if you're not a technologist, and I think you do need to think very seriously about that. If you're not a technical person, how can you start a technology company?
Well, you can
play a role.
See, the thing is, let me interrupt you there. If you become a product manager and you spend 3, 4, 5, 7 years as a product manager, you can go start a technical company, right? You know how to do something.
Here's right? where I was going before you become the product manager. Yeah. I think you should learn to code anyways, because I think it's going to make you that much more successful understanding what your team does. I tell a lot of people to learn to code.
Yeah.
You don't know. I mean, as you say, some people just have that innate ability sure. and they may surprise themselves. The flip side of that is you really do need to understand what it takes to create a product and what the level of the task is that you're asking your team to do. Is this an easy task or is this real? Are you asking them to invent something
yeah,
new?
But let me throw this at you. It's like saying, hey, do you want to build cars? Okay, great. I want to build cars. Do you know how to build cars? Well, no, I got an English degree. Okay, well, that's okay. We're going to spend a week at Jiffy Lube, and we're going to learn about changing oil and about changing tires, and we're even going to change an air filter, okay? And at the end of that, you will know what it takes to design the next engine for the next Honda to get 47 miles per gallon. Well, no, hell no. Of course you're not going to know anything about that. Right? To actually know how to build an engine? I mean, that is so far past Jiffy Lube. And you can't casually figure out how to design an engine or even casually learn how to tear an engine apart and increase the compression ratio or change out the camshaft to get better performance. That's not a casual thing. That's a big deal. You're going to break stuff. You're going to hurt yourself. You're going to cry. You're going to bleed and you're going to sweat. And you're going to, you know, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it. But that's not a casual, oh, I'm just going to learn how to do that thing. And so maybe I'm taking engineering a little too seriously, but it's hard. Coding, like really coding, making something useful, that's hard. That's a hard craft. And so, you can go to learn change oil at Jiffy Lube, but you know,
and it's not going to hurt.
You're
you.
Not a mechanic.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you're not an engineer. But you can become that if you want. But you got to love that because that's hard work. So I just say, hey, you know what? Hang out with mechanics. Go learn how to change oil. But if you show up and say, hey, you know what? I went to Jiffy Lube boot camp, and now I know actually, you know, I think you need to use a different camshaft because I read something in a magazine about these better cams. Every engineer is going to look at you and say, get out of here. We're not going to follow you. So it's a dangerous game to play if you're a non-tech guy and you want to, you know, drive
enough.
An engineering
Fair
team.
Enough. So and I appreciate your candidness. Let's take a quick break.
Sure.
And then we'll come back and talk some more with Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Our guest today is Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. So that was a nice discussion, and frankly, the other side of the coin, we more often have guests that are very motivational and say, hey, yeah, go do it. So I think it's an important it's an important piece, and folks need to understand the challenge of the task at hand, and I appreciate you being so candid. Let's come back to Instructure and where we were before we took a break and before I got you talking about coding for the rest of the world. We were talking kind of about Instructure's journey, you becoming CEO. I know one of the big breaks, one of the big inflection points for Instructure was, I believe, BYU of Hawaii was your first paying customer.
Yeah. I think it was a beta. It was a but they paid us money. They were like, I think we got like $7,000 from them towards the end of 2010, and we counted that as a customer.
And then shortly after that, at the end of 2010, there's a group called the Utah Education Network.
That was our first UEN. Real contract.
And that was yeah. multiple colleges, multiple yeah. universities in Utah, and it's
yes.
why you allude to it as being your first real contract.
Yeah. No I'm offense assuming, to BYU Hawaii. That was important to us at the time.
It's huge, but, really. Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, those guys are great. But UEN... I mean, that was over 100,000 students and faculty, and it was a multi-year contract, and we were taking that business away from Blackboard, and that was a big make-or-break moment, and we had to go through the RFP process. It was grueling, and it was just, man, that was hard, and that was make-or-break. That's, you know, we there was just a small group of us, and we were really trying to win. And if we didn't win that contract, I mean, that I I don't know what would have happened to the company.
There are points that had they gone the other way in a company's history, may not have made it.
Yeah,
I think we
had contingency plans in place. And those contingency plans were like radically changing the business model, maybe even going after a different market. I mean, it was pretty white knuckle.
So it was critical for Instructure. Interestingly, though, for your client, for the customer, probably not that much upside. There was a lot of risk. Let me put it this way: there was a lot of risk for them to make that bet and to be the first big customer.
Absolutely.
What was it about Instructure that was so compelling that there was an administrator that probably been in that job for 20 years? That if this didn't go right, 100,000 students, that person's job may have been on the line. What was it that was so compelling that they said, yes, we're going to do this?
Well, it was even more complicated than that. It was actually, you know, over a dozen administrators. It was a consortium. It was Utah State. It was U of U. It was UVU. It was all these colleges in Utah.
That's incredible.
In a consortium.
That was your first, yeah.
Well, yeah, it was a very complex contract to put together. So it was many, many administrators.
That were going to lose their jobs.
Exactly.
So multiply that risk by 12.
They were all going to look dumb if they picked us and it didn't work.
What was so compelling about Canvas at the time?
Well, Canvas was kind of everything Blackboard wasn't. It was easy to use. It was in the cloud. It was open source. It was, in many ways, the dream. It was the dream for these administrators and these faculty members that said, hey, if we could create one ourselves, it would be a lot like how Canvas is. And huge risk, but clearly it was worth the risk. And you know, that... Since then, you know, we've got over 1,300 clients all over the country.
Right. You have millions of teachers and students.
Yeah,
using. Yeah, exactly.
Millions.
And as I mentioned earlier, $500 million valuation. So you're well past that point. But I want to stay in the early days because
yeah.
It's easy to look at a company now and say, wow, what a powerhouse. You know,
yeah.
What I find really interesting is how did you become the powerhouse?
Yeah, that first year was tough. We had that was our... Jeffrey Moore crossing the chasm year is 2011, and by the end of 2011 we had 100 contracts and we're like, okay, we crossed the chasm. I think we did it. But you know, we didn't have any real, you know, we had Epic, right? They wrote us a check, but they're early stage guys. And when I came on board as CEO, I said, look, I won't take a salary. In fact, I still don't take a salary. And in fact, I'll write you another check. So I wrote a really big check and I said, look, we're going to launch this open source. We're going to put out, you know, February 1st, 2011 is going to be our launch date. We're going to tell the world we're open source and we're going to go public with our vision of what we want to do.
Thank you, because I wanted to go there. So you got this major contract, this
yeah.
consortium of universities. 3 months later, you announced to the world that you're making Canvas open source.
Exactly.
The name is descriptive, but let's take a second to describe to our audience what the difference between open source software is and non-open source.
Yeah, so open source software is software that is freely available. The source code is available. In other words, you know, when you download Microsoft Office, you get the software, but you can't get the code, right? That code is closed. Open source software, you can actually read the code. You can change the code. You can, and you don't have to pay for the code. It's just out there.
It would be, to use your analogy, it would be like Microsoft Word being changeable at the individual level. If they didn't like the code and they want something else, you could change it. And you also would not have to pay for it.
Right. And in fact, someone could take Microsoft Office and change it and make it called Microloft Roffice and sell it. And Microsoft would be like, wait a second, that's our software. And you'd say, so what? It's open source.
Okay, so you're in this tough space. You're in this very tough educational technology space. And now you've given away your revenue model and it's free. So how does Instructure make money in that situation?
Yeah, so it turns out that the learning management system for a college campus is pretty mission critical. If it's not up and running, the school kind of shuts down in a lot of ways. It's a big deal. And so people pay us to run this system in the cloud and to continuously add features and functionality and bug fixes. And that's why they pay us. And they're happy to pay us because we're really, really good at that.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back with Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. Welcome back to The Bottom Line in KCPW. I'm Doug Wells, and our guest this morning is Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. So we were talking about open source software, and we kind of give away the software, and it's really the service component. It's mission critical. It has to be up and running, and you probably have annual contracts with the schools to make sure that it stays up and running and has all the security that it needs. And if there's any challenges, if the system goes down for a minute, it's only down for a minute. It's not down for 2 days. Big change. And again, by today's standard, that's a fairly normal business practice. When you did it in 2011, the business model was still being perfected, really still being invented. So you got UEN, the consortium of a dozen universities here in Utah as a customer. A couple months later, you go to open source. A couple months later, you raise an $8 million round. So clearly, the venture capital community was comfortable with the business model at a time when it wasn't clear how that would play out. How did you share that vision and get people comfortable that giving away this software was the right model?
Oh, certainly risky. You risk cannibalization, you know, where, you know, your market starts taking your product away from your salespeople. and so that was a risk, and no one knew how that was going to turn out. But it within just a few months, it became very apparent that these schools loved the idea of open source, but desperately wanted a commercial partner to help them run their school's learning system, and so that risk was, you know, not realized, which was great. We found an investor back east to write a big check for us, and we kept running
and
our
Epic
business.
Epic participated as well.
Yeah,
in that round. I think you did it also as an individual.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know that part of your history. One of your early employees at Instructure, I don't know if Sunny Washington.
In fact, yes.
She helped
great.
Us line up this interview, so we thank Sunny for making that happen. And she's doing her own startup now as well. So I knew a little bit about your story, both from what I've just read in the press as well as my conversations with Sunny. But I didn't know how early you guys went open source. And at first, I was really surprised because in 2011, people just weren't doing that, right?
Certainly not in the academic space. We were the first commercial open source learning management
now,
system.
Now it's pretty standard, but back then it wasn't.
Yeah, there's a couple of open source projects out there, but a venture-funded ed tech company that's open source, that's not
still pretty rare.
Yeah,
still pretty rare.
Yeah, sure.
What I love about that story, though, when I first read it, I was like, wow. You know, I was surprised, and I was trying to put the pieces together just in my mind, and how did the strategy at that time make sense. But what I loved about you guys going open source is you were 180 degrees opposite of Blackboard. And there is some beauty in that. When you're going up against the big behemoth, you can try to pair up closely to them and say, we're as good as Blackboard, or you can take the riskier strategy and say, we're very, very different, and here's how we're different. And from that vantage point, that lens, it made a lot of sense. Were you guys consciously aware of that we have to be everything that Blackboard is not?
Yeah, we kind of had a pretty...
I mean, your mission somewhere, so I'm paraphrasing here, but it's beat Blackboard. I mean,
used to talk a lot about that in the early days.
Yeah.
Not so much anymore.
Because you've beaten them.
Well,
good for you.
In many ways, yes. But yeah, the early strategy was simply, well, let's just do the opposite of Blackboard and we should be fine. And
there's a Seinfeld episode on that too.
Yeah, it was. I mean, actually, my second startup philosophy was actually, I'm going to do the opposite of what I did in my first startup, which was a massive train wreck. And so there's a nice simplicity to seeing something that doesn't work and just doing the opposite.
We're going to come back to your first startup, and there were a lot of successes along the way. also.
I've had lots of failures and successes.
And I think that's part of what makes every entrepreneur's story interesting. For now, let's stay with Instructure and your product. So 2012, you went open source. You were dealing with universities. And it was later, right around the same time you went open source, that you introduced Canvas for K through 12 schools. Prior to that, it was just colleges and universities. What was it about the K through 12 market that you saw that you said there's an opportunity here? And was, I don't know, was Blackboard already a player in that space?
So, to answer the Blackboard question, yeah, they had tried to get into K-12 for a number of years, but generally were not successful, mostly because K through 12 schools don't have the IT staff to manage software on premise or data centers. If you have a cloud offering, hey, K through 12 schools can plug into the cloud. So that was a big advantage we had. But what we noticed is at the end of 2011, we looked back on the 100 or so contracts we had, and about half a dozen or a dozen of them were K through 12 school districts. We thought, well, that's strange. Where'd these guys come from?
Because it really wasn't a tool designed for them.
No, it was really for higher ed. But what we found is a lot of these K through 12 schools were looking at their local colleges, you know, the community colleges or the university that were near their school districts, and saying, hey, they're using something cool. We want our high school kids to get a leg up. And they were reaching out to us. And it worked reasonably well for the K through 12 school districts. And so in 2012, we made a conscious decision, let's make a K-12 edition of Canvas. And so in 2012, we went into that market.
You know, it's a common theme with startups where they start to get their traction is they have a user base that they never thought that they would have. PayPal has a similar story. You know, actually, the guys at PayPal really, I think Peter Thiel is quoted as saying, they didn't like the fact that people on eBay were using PayPal. You know, they were afraid somehow it was going to turn into this scam thing. And they actually, in the early days, actively worked to make it harder to use PayPal on eBay. And despite that, people kept using it and eventually said, there's a big market here. And of course, everybody knows PayPal got bought by eBay and has since been spun out again. So that's often a really interesting data point for you if you have users that are using your
get pulled into the market.
Well said. So 2012 was a busy year for you guys. You went open source, you introduced the K through 12 version, and then at the end of the year you got into what we commonly call MOOCs, massively open online courses. Tell our audience, what is a MOOC and what did you see there that said this is an attractive opportunity?
So right around, say, the end of 2012 or sometime in 2013, a couple of offshoots from Stanford, from the computer science department, started opening up their courses to the world for free. And it started sort of this craze called the MOOC craze, the massive open online course craze, where you would have 100,000 people sign up for a class. And the early courses that were really successful were Stanford computer science courses. A couple of startups came out of Stanford, Udacity, Coursera, and they got a lot of venture capital. And a lot of people, for a while, the New York Times, it seemed, would publish an article every week on this. They just, you know, a lot of the press just fell in love with this concept. A vision of massive disruption of the university system, and just, you know, 14-year-old girls in Afghanistan getting chemical engineering degrees, in their village from MOOCs. You know, it was a really it challenged the imagination for what was possible in the future. Unfortunately, about a year or two later, reality set in. Now, we were interested in MOOCs, and we still are, and we actually are the third largest MOOC provider in the world, the Canvas Network. You can go to canvas.net and see an enormous number of free classes.
And just as a quick aside, people should do that. It is amazing the classes that are there, and you can learn a lot. Are you ever going to be a practicing chemical engineer by doing that? Probably not, but amazing what is available for free through these MOOCs.
It's incredible, And what was interesting, so we participated in this experiment, the MOOC experiment. Now, we didn't spend, you know, $50 million in venture capital doing it, right? We were a little more prudent, I think, in our approach. What turned out is that they found that the typical MOOC student was like a 37-year-old white guy that listens to NPR that already had a college degree. That's the typical MOOC user. And that's not going to change the world. That's more of infotainment, and it's fun and interesting. And the rate of course completion was, you know, around 7%.
And there's no certification at the end.
Yeah, or even if there is a certification, no one cares about it. There's a
certainly
lot of
no
problems.
Stanford degree at the end.
Right,
of it.
Right. Maybe you get a Stanford certificate and you put a little gold star on your LinkedIn account, but it's not the same as getting a degree. So I think MOOCs now, looking back, right, it's 2015 now, and now I think looking back on that interesting year and a half of MOOC hype, MOOCs are now, I think, an important part of the education technology ecosystem. But they didn't change the world. The colleges didn't shut their doors down and say, "Oh, you were right. Yeah, I guess we don't need this campus. Let's do everything online for free now."
I think I think we're still in the early stage myself on MOOCs, and I think it's a very interesting space to leverage the talents of teachers, and that's the iteration that I'm waiting to see play out. And my gut tells me that'll work. That there is a place for teachers, for folks like yourself that were an adjunct professor, maybe for folks that didn't have the experience set that you did, and they can become better teachers and more effective teachers by using some of the tools with MOOCs.
I think within 20 years, you're going to have some place you can go, and you will be able to shop for courses and build a degree. You'll say, "Hey, look, here's my budget. I got $10,000. I have 36 months. I want to get a degree in English literature, and I want to graduate from Brown. Okay, you know, let's do a search like Amazon, and a bunch of courses will show up that fulfill your requirements, and you go shop for courses, you read reviews, oh, there's a 3-star course, there's a 5-star course, and this is how much this is, and you will be able to build your own degree and then take it partially at the local campus and partially online, and I think that eventually will happen, but I think we're a couple decades away from that virtual disruption of
education.
I
think you're probably right. The interesting thing about the educational space is, for whatever reason, they got passed over in the first and the second wave of technology innovation, much like our healthcare system has been.
Yep.
And that's why there's still low-hanging fruit in the healthcare system that technology can really improve and improve quickly. And I think it's the same thing with education.
Yeah.
So I think we're still in the early innings
for
education, and it's going to be really exciting to see not only MOOCs but the rest of the space, particularly what you guys are doing. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. Let's move on. You know, I just mentioned how, in my opinion, healthcare and education was largely leaped over during the technology innovation. There's a lot of folks looking at that space now. A space that was not looked over, though, was corporations, right? There was some low-hanging fruit. Corporations have large budgets. They can, if need be, they can make decisions quickly and unilaterally. They don't need committee. They don't need city councils. They don't need school boards to approve things. And you've recently moved into the corporate space, giving them some tools to manage their training. I believe your product's name is Bridge.
That's right.
What did you see in the corporate space that made you think, you know what, we want to enter this fray that potentially is much more competitive and further along already than the education space?
Well, similar to K-12, what we found was we looked back at about 7% of our contracts were with corporations, not with schools. And they were using Canvas to train their employees or to train their customers as outreach. And you know what? Canvas actually isn't that good at that for companies. It's awesome for schools.
But despite that, 7% of your customers were using it for that.
Yeah. And that told us, hey, something must be wrong in that market. And so we started looking into it. And what we found is a very fragmented market with lots and lots of training software systems out there, and most of them really weren't that good. So we saw an opportunity. We said, "Hey, you know what? Let let's teach the world, let's make the world a better place by making people smarter, whether they're in a classroom or a factory floor or a boardroom or in a research center. Just because we're good at creating software that helps people learn, and so we expanded into that, and the product is called Bridge.
And how long ago was that? And are you guys now a major player in that space?
No, we're far from a major player in that space, but we're making very fast progress. We launched just earlier this year, and we're growing very, very quickly. But we're just a couple of quarters into the game.
Good. Well, best of luck for that. I want to transition and talk a little bit about your journey. So we've mentioned a couple of your companies, Scale8, and Mosey.
Mosey.
I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yep.
Let's start with Mosey.
Okay.
Start to finish, that was under 3 years.
Yeah, it was pretty quick.
And a huge success, sold for just under $80 million to EMC.
Yep.
What was the original idea for Mosey, and how do you think you were able to scale that so quickly?
Well, it was a pretty focused effort. Mosey was really about, I like building things, and I like building big, interesting things. And my background's in large-scale parallel data storage. That's kind of my thing. And online backup, there's a lot of interesting problems to solve in that space. So Mosey was about building a very large data storage system and disrupting a model of online backup. Online backup's something that Mosey certainly did invent. But our approach was, hey, $5 a month, unlimited. And that was a disruptive model. And we were able to do that because of some technology that I developed to really lower the operational costs of managing massive storage systems in the back end. And so that's what Mosey was about. And Mosey, I started Mosey not to, to really build something cool and then sell it and retire. And that was the plan. It was a simple plan. And everyone who joined Mosey, I sat them down and said, hey, this is the plan. Do you want to be part of this or not? And even the investors, I said, look, guys, this is not going to the NASDAQ. I want to build something cool. I want to feel really good about what I built. And then I want to sell it and then move on.
Very seldom do things work out just as planned like that. I mean, in this case, it sounds like almost all those pieces fell into place perfectly for you. Were there any hiccups along the way with Mosey?
Well, yeah, there was a few. There was a few. But it actually, it was pretty textbook. I learned all the things not to do in my first startup, which was a massive train wreck. And at Mosey, it was hard. I mean, it was hard. It was stressful. It was an enormous amount of work. It was a lot of nail biting. Great little team, though. You know, there's probably about a dozen of us for most of those 2.5 years that we, before the buyout. I think when we were sold, I think we had 30 or 40 employees, but the majority of the time we were maybe a dozen or so.
So let me talk to you about that hard work, because it is, right? It's 80, it's 100-hour work weeks. And I think one of the things that's challenging with entrepreneurship is you don't know the outcome. If you knew the outcome, you'd say, am I willing to put in 100-hour work weeks for 36 months to be financially independent the rest of my life? I think most people would say, I'll do whatever it takes. What makes it hard is you don't know that outcome. And so psychologically, how did you deal with that? Particularly, we're going to talk about Scale8 in a minute, which
sure.
You just called the train wreck.
Yeah.
After having one that looked like it was going to be a huge success and have it not play out that way.
I don't know. I mean, I can't really respond to that without just sounding like a fortune cookie and, a cliche, right? You have faith in what you're trying to do.
Was it a challenge for you, or did you?
Oh,
just,
yeah,
I'm not going to think about that.
No, it was. Oh, you mean was it a challenge for me to
mentally
to have doubts, or
to put in that kind of effort? I mean, you mentioned you have young kids.
Yeah.
You're missing out on stuff.
Yeah,
right? There's things happening at home that you just can't go to the ballet recitals and the baseball games.
Yeah.
And there's a sacrifice. There's a cost to it.
Yeah.
How did you deal with that? were you just that committed and you just knew it was going to happen? Or how did you deal with that trade-off?
Well, my wife and I, it was part of our plan, right? We said, hey, let's make a plan, you know, and we made a plan and we executed on the plan and it worked. I don't know what else to say. It was a little bit of a fairy tale, the Mosey plan.
And fairy tales do happen occasionally.
Yeah.
And that's part of the attraction of entrepreneurship. If you're just joining us today, our guest is Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. So we just have time for a couple more questions, but I do want to talk about the Scale 8 experience. I mean, this was a company you'd raised a lot of money for, $65 million somewhere in that ballpark. You were featured prominently in the Wall Street Journal and other top news organizations. Ultimately, didn't succeed. The IP assets were sold to, I believe, Intel.
Yeah.
Tell us what Scale 8 did, what some of the things is that you did well, and then ultimately why you think it didn't succeed at the level that you were hoping.
Well, so Scale 8 went on for about 4 years. It was a four-year slow-motion train wreck. And we had four CEOs in 4 years. And we had, Harvard MBAs, lots of gray hair, really top venture capitalists from Sand Hill Road. We were based in San Francisco. We tried to grow big fast. I mean, it was your typical 1999 venture startup, and brick and beam office in South of Market. And we spent lots of money because we just knew if we built it, they would come, and they didn't show up.
Which is why your first advice to a technical founder is quit coding and go out and talk to the marketplace.
That's an important part of that, yes.
That was a $65 million lesson that you learned.
I got an MBA. It cost me $65 million. And I was the CTO. I was the founder, but I had the role of CTO and VP of engineering for about two and a half of those 4 years. And I knew, hey, I don't know how to run a business. And so that's why we brought in the professionals and the grown-ups. And what I really learned out of that is no one knows what the hell they're doing. They just don't, right? It doesn't matter what their resume says. It just, most CEOs are knuckleheads. And I got a great sample set. I got the best sample set in the world.
And that was the model back then.
Yeah,
right? You have the founder. Then you bring in the quote-unquote
professional
managers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that model is largely replaced now. And I think Andreessen Horowitz gets a lot of credit for saying, you know what, for recognizing there's something magical about a founder. And as you say, nobody knows how to do that job. I think of it as the president of the United States. Oftentimes people say, well, they haven't had this experience or that experience,
sure,
so we shouldn't vote for him. You know, the president of the United States is such an overwhelming job. Nobody's ready for it. And I think in many ways, it's the same thing with the CEO. And so if you choose your investors wisely, if you choose your team wisely, you can support folks with people that can teach you what you need to know.
Yeah, I value resumes a lot less than I value people that have failed and succeeded. That cycle, failure, success cycle, school of hard knocks, whatever, what have you. That's really important. What it says on your resume, I think, is less interesting. But the thing is, though, it's a mix, though, because I mean, a lot of founders are wackos, right, and delusional.
You kind of have to be in some regards.
Well, yeah, but then a lot of those don't succeed because they get in their own way. Now and then, some of them are wackos that are wildly successful, right? It's a mix, you know. So there's the trope of the wild and crazy founder that's out in left field and just makes it and he's successful. Those happen sometimes, but for every one that happens to, there's 10 that just, you
know. What would be two or three characteristics that you think are critical for a CEO?
For a CEO, gosh.
Founder CEO.
Yeah, founder CEO type role. Well, I think the most important is self-awareness. You got to know what you're good at and what you're not good at. And you can't believe your own lies. I mean, it my first startup, man, I go back and I review some of the old financial models we built. And I just think, I can't believe that grown-ups in a room together would look at this model and actually believe it. Like, I don't – who would do that? I mean, it's crazy.
And
right?
Think of all the hours that were spent putting that projection
enormous
together.
Yeah, crazy. And so it's really – I think the most important thing is just to be real with yourself, with your company, with your investors. And that is super hard. So that's, I think, the number one thing is to be real.
I think that's great advice. That's a great characteristic. I think the other one is persistence, just because it is so hard. And at the end of the journey, everybody's going to look back and say, hey, I really want to be Josh Coates, right? But there's a lot of days where it ain't so fun being Josh Coates.
Sure. Well, no. See, here's the thing is, I'll tell you what it's like being Josh Coates a little bit, or any successful person in the venture tech world. You got half the people that think you're just an amazing genius, and you get the other half that think you're an idiot and a fraud, and neither of them are right. And that's what you have to live with. So,
and that's why you go to being aware. The characteristic you mentioned for an entrepreneur is being self-aware, so you know who you are. I think that's great advice. Last question for you, and I want to come back to Instructure. You raised a $40 million round earlier this year, a little over a $500 million valuation. It's a great compliment to you and your team that you've gotten this far. I was surprised you were quoted as calling this your pre-IPO round. What is it about doing an IPO that you think is likely in the future for Instructure? Why is that kind of in the cards already?
Well, I think it's important to be independent. And I think if you're public, that gives you that independence where you're accountable to the public, you're accountable to your shareholders. But being private, it's such an uncertain future when you're private. And I think certainly you can build a cash cow business and keep it closely held. For tech companies, I think that's a disservice. I think maintaining that trajectory of growth and then opening yourself up to the public and investors is something that allows you to tell your customers and your partners and your employees, hey, we can stand alone. We can stand alone and be out there on our own. And I think that's an important declaration. And of course, it's not a destination, right? All it is a milestone on the journey. A ton of hard work happens after you go public. But it's an exciting kind of declaration of independence for us.
Yeah, well put. You know, I think the reason it was surprising when I read it is, at least from my vantage point, the trend seems to be to wait longer and longer. I mean, there's lots of examples, and there's probably plenty on the other side as well. You've got Facebook, you've got Uber, you've got Airbnb.
Yeah.
That all Airbnb and Uber probably at this point would have already gone public, and Facebook, which is now public, would have gone public much earlier at a different time than they do today.
You have these unicorn syndrome that's going around, right?
I made it the whole interview without using that word.
So, yeah, exactly. Well, so... What happens is you get these really sexy, trendy, fast-growing companies that are doing well, and a lot of them are closely held. A lot of them are bootstrapped. Not all of them, but a lot of them. Especially here in Utah, because I think in Utah, there not a lot of people are really familiar with the pattern of venture capital. And so what they do is, because they're not familiar with that pattern, they trade time for ownership. So they'll spend a decade building a company, and they'll build a great company, but they'll use 10, 12, 14 years doing it. And by the end of those dozen years, they have a company worth a lot of money that they own almost all of it. And so a private equity firm will show up and say, hey, you know what? How about we cash some of that out? We'll make you really wealthy. Just let us in on the deal. So that happens. But what happens is that investor now has to let it bake in the oven longer. So they say, hey, you know, I know you were thinking about an IPO, but now that I'm here, let's wait a couple of years and see if we can get it even bigger. And then another private equity firm shows up and says, hey, I want a little piece of that too. And it just pushes it back. So you have a lot of unicorns that have traded time and money. And so they're letting it ride a little longer. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. It's just a phenomena that we're seeing, especially here with several companies here in Utah. And so that's a strategy. Now, The danger, of course, is if you know the bubble we're in bursts, and suddenly you get a lot of private companies that get underwater with their last valuation. Private valuations tend to be significantly higher than public valuations. The sooner we get to a public valuation, frankly, the more safe and stable and sane I'm going to feel, right? A hyperinflated private valuation scares the crap out of me because you know what? I was there. The year was 2000. It hurt. I want nothing to do that again. I think some of these guys that are doing the unicorn stuff, I don't know. They were still in high school when that happened, maybe. because I got the scars, man. And so we're playing it a little safer in that way. But what's exciting about Utah is that there's so many great tech startups that are out there that are successful right now. And it's awesome to be part of this ecosystem.
It really is. In fact, 10 years ago, you wrote an article critiquing the investor base here in Utah. And I said the last question was the last question, but we're on the subject and I'd like to circle back to it. Do you think it's different now? It's a decade later. Do you still see, do you think we have the investor community here in Utah that we need to have today for the unicorns that are going to be made over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, 10 years ago I wrote Poison in the Well, and in response
And it
to,
was poison. It was. I mean,
I
asking
sincerely
an entrepreneur,
believe so.
Asking an entrepreneur to give a personal guarantee on your investment, these are risky investments.
Yeah.
And the entrepreneur puts in the time, the passion, and the energy, but they shouldn't have to personally guarantee your investment.
Yeah, you know, going and doing a startup and then losing your house on top of it. I mean, well, anyway, but the good news is things have changed dramatically. And I think the angel community and the incubator community has matured. And I think they're realizing, hey, you know what? Those guys in Silicon Valley actually kind of know what they're doing. We should be more like them. And I think over the last decade, we've taken major steps in that direction. I don't see the same kind of stupid stuff that was being pulled 10 years ago here in the angel community, which is really nice. And I think that has significantly contributed to the ecosystem we have today is when you play by the Silicon Valley rules, you know, great stuff happens. You know, they've done a good job out there and you give them credit. You know, it's a little bit of Utah pride, not invented here kind of stuff. But you know what? Hey, if something works really well, I think it's not a bad idea to
Let's emulate that and build on it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we've done a great job here in Utah.
I agree. And that's a great note for us to end on. Josh, I thank you for joining us this morning and sharing these great stories with us and a little bit about your journey. Thank you for joining us today on The Bottom Line.
Thanks so much.
Our guest this morning has been Josh Coates, CEO of Instructure. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thanks for all your help, Ross. You can hear my entire interview with Josh on our website, kcpw.org. You can also tweet me, @SavvyWells, or @KCPWBottomLine. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.